Well, good afternoon. My watch says it's 5 o'clock, and it's good to see that there's still a good crowd of folks here. My job here today is to bring you up to date on some of the issues that we're having with Palmer in the southeast. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the distribution. I'm going to tell you about some of our other concerns with it. And then I'm going to cover the recommendations that the southeast as a group have come up with. In terms of where we find it at, I still want to blame Stanley Culpepper for all these problems that we've had. He initially found it down in Macon County, Georgia in 2004. Through 2007, he's confirmed it in 18 counties. He's looking at some more populations from additional counties this year. Most likely we'll fill in some more of those counties there. North Carolina. We picked it up in 2005, did a pretty big screening study that year, and we confirmed it in 11 counties, those in the red. Since that point, we've not made a major effort to do follow-up screenings, but I'm very comfortable saying that we've got it in an additional 11 counties. South Carolina, they initially found it in 2006. Through 2007, they had confirmed it in 11 counties, and I know Mike Marshall from Clemson is screening some additional populations this year for some other counties. They're probably going to cover in a few more of those. And I'm not up to date on what the situation is in Alabama, but I understand there's a county or two with some suspicious populations down there, and they're in the process of trying to confirm it there. But we're conservatively estimating we have 600,000 acres infested in the Georgia Carolinas area. For us, Palmer is pretty much confined to the coastal plain soils. You can find it in the clay soils in the western part of North Carolina or South Carolina, but it's not much there. It's basically right now a coastal plain issue. And as fast as we're seeing it spread, we think it's pretty much as Larry just said, if we're in the coastal plain, we might as well just assume we either got it or it's awful close to getting it. I think as we come to grips with this thing and try to figure out how we're going to deal with it, one of the first things we got to do is accept we have a problem. And Stanley talked about that this morning in a presentation. We have had some extensive educational programs, and I think there's a few holdouts yet, but overall our people have decided, yep, I got a problem. I'm going to have to do something about it. And we're beginning to see some changes being made. I think the bottom line is this problem ain't going away for several reasons. One of them is just this massive seed production. Culpepper's group has shown that a single plant can make 450,000 seed. And that's not some monster plant growing out by itself. That's one that's growing in competition with a crop. So obviously, that kind of seed production, the implications are clear. You can get some tremendous populations built up in a hurry. And when you're dealing with that kind of population, 95% control, and that's probably what that guy on the right there had, it just is a disaster. I feel sure that it's safe to say that the mutation or mutations that have led to this are pretty widespread across the populations. We're seeing it pop up in too many places too quickly. And therefore, I think we're continuing to select for it. I think we're seeing that we are spreading the resistant biotype around. Traditional things like spreading it on harvesting equipment, spreading it in gin trash. But there's been several mentions made of the pollen movement. Some work that Culpepper's group in Georgia has done, they have shown that you can take a resistant male, and the pollen can move 1,000 feet, fertilize a female, and you get resistant seed. And that's 1,000 feet in any direction. You can do the math on that. That comes out to be a pretty big area. What's the implications of that? The implication is, if you don't have 100% control in your field, your neighbor's resistance is going to come see you. Another issue we have in cotton. There is no salvage post-emergence options. We did a study, I'll show you the data here in a minute, but we were simulating the situation where we didn't realize we had a problem. We sprayed the glyphosate, it didn't work, and then we said, oh Lord, what am I going to do now? So we picked out fields that had mixed populations of resistant and susceptible biotypes, and I'll emphasize here that these fields did not have ALS resistance. We sprayed our glyphosate timely. Of course, the resistant ones didn't die. 10 days later, we came in with some salvage treatments. Of course, by that time, the palmer was already 8 to 10 inches tall. Later on, we came in with some lay-by treatments. Our treatments consisted of all combinations of Cotteran, MSMA, and staple. That's basically our choices. The MSMA basically didn't help us out very much, so the data I'm showing you here is averaged over the two rates of MSMA. But the first red bar on your left, that 22% control, that's what we had out of the glyphosate and the lay-by treatments. This data here is recorded 30 days after the lay-by. And the red bars there show the effect of Cotteran alone. You can tell that 4 pints of Cotteran gave us 43% control. And that's, again, remember that was followed up with lay-bys. The first yellow bar on your left is staple alone, 50% control, and you can tell it didn't help much to mix staple with Cotteran. Bottom line is, and again I emphasize, this is ALS susceptible here, we can't salvage a glyphosate failure. The implication, you get it pre or you don't get it. ALS resistance, widespread in Palmer amaranth across the southeast. And we know there are populations where we have multiple resistance. It's resistant to glyphosate and our ALS inhibitors. And here's just a picture out of Georgia that shows one of those populations. Another concern, we're becoming very much concerned about the potential for resistance in Palmer to PPO inhibitors. Far as I know, we don't have it in the southeast yet, but we depend very heavily on these PPO inhibitors. We use them in cotton, we use them in soybeans, we use them in peanuts. If we got resistance to PPOs on top of glyphosate and ALS, I'm not sure what we would do. Many of you probably seen this article in the Southeast Farm Press recently. They're talking about water hemp. Larry mentioned it was a first cousin to Palmer. In some of the Midwest areas, they have water hemp that's resistant to glyphosate, ALS inhibitors, triazines, and PPO inhibitors. We in the Southeast have worked very closely together on this issue. We have come up with some recommendations that pretty much are the same across all the states. Programs that we're recommending are similar, whether you're talking about dealing with a resistance problem that's already in place or you're trying to avoid it. The big difference is in the intensity of the programs. We know that Roundup Ready technology has had tremendous impacts on how we've handled weed control programs in cotton. Allowed us to reduce or eliminate soil-applied herbicides. Now, we had reams of data that said for most situations, if we were timely with that first application, we could make glyphosate-only programs work. Growers picked up on that quickly. They were glad to get rid of the real and perceived problems with soil-applied herbicides. Another impact of glyphosate or Roundup Ready technology, it allowed us to get away from cultivation. We saved on equipment, we saved on labor costs. It allowed us to successfully go to no-till. But the bottom line of all of that is we put unprecedented selection pressure on glyphosate, and we have selected for resistance. If you start thinking about what can you do for resistance management, bottom line is you're trying to reduce selection pressure on any particular product. So if you're talking about a resistance management program for glyphosate, you're talking about incorporating additional modes of action into your programs. We can no longer depend on glyphosate-only programs. So we're talking about aggressive residual pre-emergence programs. We're talking about tank mixes post-emergence to bring us some more residual. We're talking about full use rates. You can argue whether or not reduced rates of glyphosate contributed to the problems we got. And I don't know. But I think it's safe to say it didn't help anything. So we're pushing full rates. It's a rare grower who wants to cultivate. But certainly in some of these worse areas, I know in Georgia, some of the hardest hit areas, they've had to go back and start cultivating. And Stanley talked this morning, if you heard his presentation, he talked about prevention. We are trying our best to get growers to be very vigilant about looking for escapes and not letting them seed out. That one plant right there, that could be several thousand plants next year. So we need to try to catch these problems, get rid of them as early as possible. Now, for reasons I've already mentioned, we are pushing aggressive pre-plant or pre-emergence programs. This may be a single herbicide if we don't already have a problem with resistance. If we already have a problem, it may be a tank mix or multiple, say a pre-plant and a pre. I'm going to show you some data here. This data comes out of five locations in Georgia and North Carolina. We are looking at various pre-emergence herbicides for Palmer control. And the only thing that this farmer saw was these pre-treatments. And I'll also emphasize that these populations here were not ALS resistant. But you can see there that we had the best control with Reflex or Staple. Intermediate was with Direx or Cotoran. And then we had the least control with Prowl and Caparol. Now, I understand that those of you in the Mid-South have some concerns over Reflex pre-emergence because of injury. In the Southeast, on our sandy soils, yes, we sometimes see some injury, but it's basically no more than we'd expect with any pre-herbicide. So it has worked well for us. We also use a lot of Valor pre-plant burn downs in the Southeast. And I included Valor in this particular test, and I emphasize in this case that the Valor went out the same day as the Reflex and the Staple. But you can see that the control was very, very similar to Reflex and Staple. In the real world, where you're putting Valor out 2 or 3 weeks ahead of planting, you got more time for it to break down. By the time you get out to 40 days here, it would have probably not been quite as well. One of the issues with Valor, what we call no-till in the Southeast, most of it is strip-till. We see a benefit from running a ripper on the row to break hard pans. We typically do that strip-till operation at or close to planting after the Valor has gone out. And what we see sometimes is when we disturb that area, when we run the strip-till rig, we see a break of weeds. And so we're also now recommending, even if we've got Valor out pre-plant, we're recommending at least a band of something else behind the planter to take care of this issue. We're also seeing that in some of these heavier infestations, we probably need to be looking at a tank mix of materials pre-emergence. And what you see here is some work from North Carolina that basically shows that combinations of two materials are better than individuals alone. Palmer amaranth just keeps on coming up. And so in addition to getting that aggressive pre down to start with, we like to see some additional residuals in that program. So we're looking at things like dual post-emergence and then some kind of residual material at lay-by. I mentioned the concern that we had about the possibility of getting resistance to PPO inhibitors. We are consciously trying to get our growers to limit PPO applications to one per year. Obviously, this is an intensive program here. If we're just trying to avoid a problem, we may not need all of these components. But where we have a problem with resistance, this is about what it takes to deal with it. And I'll show you this picture here to make the point. This is no-till cotton. Heavy infestation of resistant Palmer. And the point of it is, we can make these systems work. The big thing there is, I think Larry mentioned how critical it is or how dependent we are on rainfall. If the pre doesn't work, you're up the creek. And for that reason, I like to see something out ahead of planting, something out pre-plant residual, to give us a better chance of catching a rainfall. The point is, these programs can work. We're going to see a lot more soybeans planted in the Southeast this year. And we have some more options in soybeans to deal with this problem. And I think we need to take advantage of them where we can to try to reduce some of these seed banks. In soybeans, we're recommending pretty much the same thing. We're going in with a good pre-program, and we're following it up with tank mixes as needed post. But as you can see here, we do have an opportunity to begin to get a handle on some of these problems in soybeans. I'll close with this and say we are certainly are facing a serious challenge here, but I don't think it's hopeless. There's a lot of good people working on this problem. You've heard a lot in this meeting here about the new technologies that's coming, so hopefully we're going to be able to get a handle on this problem. If we have time, I'll be glad to answer any questions. Thank you.